A scathing report out today details what Governor Baker calls an abject failure of leadership in the handling of the coronavirus outbreak at the Soldiers' Home in Holyoke late March. Here he is speaking at a press conference earlier today.
But as this report reveals, errors were made at the Holyoke Soldiers' Home before COVID-19. More errors were made in preparation for COVID-19. And still more errors were made during the home's initial clinical response to the pandemic in March.
WBUR's Miriam Wasser has been following the story, and she joins us now. Hey, Miriam.
Hey, Chris.
So there's some pretty tough stuff in this report. Can you give us a sense? What were some of the key findings that were released today?
Sure. So this report, and just to back up for a minute, this investigation was ordered by the governor in late March after it came to light that a number of veterans had died in the Holyoke Soldiers' Home. And it was unclear why people higher up in the state didn't know about what happened and if there was a miscommunication or some sort of cover-up, which something people were talking about. So this report that came out today, first of all, it said there was no cover-up into the outbreak, which is something that we are looking to figure out. But more importantly, the report found that the fact that the outbreak occurred isn't itself an indication that the management team and State Department of Veteran Affairs failed. I'm going to read a quote here from the report. It said, some of the critical decisions made by Mr. Walsh, and he was the home superintendent who was put on administrative leave, and his leadership team during the final 2 weeks of March 2020 were utterly baffling from an infection control perspective and were inconsistent with the home's mission to treat its veterans with honor and dignity. Wow. So one of the most striking examples cited by the report is something that we have reported on in the past, which was the leadership's decision to combine two floors of residence in late March, on Friday, March 27th. And this move, they knowingly combined two floors of veterans where some had tested negative and some were presumed to be positive and had tested positive with residents that were showing no symptoms. So they mixed presumably COVID positive and COVID negative patients and said that they did this for staffing shortage reasons. So here's what the report said about that. Rather than isolating those with the disease from those who are asymptomatic, a basic tenet of infection control, the consolidation of these two units resulted in more than 40 veterans crowded into a space designed to hold 25. This overcrowding was the opposite of infection control. Instead, it put those who are asymptomatic at even greater risk of contracting COVID-19. So beyond the consolidation, and feel free to jump in here, the report noted six other substantial failures by the leadership team there. One was not isolating patients suspected of having the virus, not immediately testing veterans who showed COVID-19 symptoms, waiting too long to close common spaces in the home, rotating staff among units, not having consistent policies for personal protective equipment, and failing to properly document the problem and keep records.
So much of what you just outlined for us seems so obviously the wrong move when you're facing this kind of pandemic. I know the report included some thoughts from staff. What were some things that staff were talking about the situation?
Yeah, so staff and some of the stuff were things that we have reported in the past when I've talked to staff, but I mean, they... You know, there's lines in there about staff being traumatized from the decision. You know, they talked about feeling like they were walking people to. Here's a good quote. A recreational therapist who is instructed to help with the move said that she felt like she was, quote, walking the veterans to their death, and that the veterans were terrified. Another social worker felt like moving a concentration camp. We are moving these unknowing veterans off to die. And other people said, you know, I'll never get these images out of my mind. What we did, what was done to these veterans, where's the respect and dignity for these men? I mean, staff have been reporting all along that they've been horrified by the moves that management has asked them to make and that some of the things that they had to do.
Yeah, pretty staggering to see all that in one place. And as I said, it's some tough stuff in there for anybody. I'm sure family members of veterans who lost their lives to COVID are having an incredible tough time to read through some of this. Have you had a chance to speak to any of the affected family members?
I did. This afternoon, I spoke to a woman named Cheryl Malandrinos, and her father-in-law died from COVID-19 because of this outbreak. He was in the Holyoke Soldiers Home, and I believe we have a piece of tape from my interview with her.
I'm not surprised at what the report shows, being someone who's gone out, gone in and out of the facility a lot. We can see that there were definite missteps here, and those missteps led to veterans dying, and people need to be held accountable for that.
And do you feel like that's happening right now?
The jury's still out on that one. You can resign a position, it doesn't mean you're absolved.
So, as she said, this is obviously it's hard to read this report, but a lot of what they is in the report are things that they were hearing too from people at the home.
That's unbelievable. I think you asked there about accountability. That's obviously, I think, something a lot of folks are going to be thinking about now is who is to blame for this and what are the consequences? We've got a little bit of sound of Governor Baker talking about that at the press conference earlier today.
Our administration did not properly oversee the superintendent and his team during this tenure. The lack of oversight contributed to the tragic failure to protect the veterans at the Soldiers Home when COVID-19 struck vulnerable patients in the long-term care facility.
So we know Secretary of Veterans Affairs Francisco Llerena resigned yesterday. Do we know exactly what led to his resignation and what his role in this situation was?
Yeah, so Francisco Llerena is someone who also has no, or like the superintendent of the Soldiers Home, Bennett Walsh, had no medical experience, no oversight. I mean, no experience overseeing any sort of nursing home or medical management team. But it was Bennett Walsh, the superintendent of the Holyoke Soldiers Home, reported directly to Francisco Llerena, who then reported to Health and Human Services. And as we found out today, Health and Human Services Secretary Mary Lou Sutters asked Llerena to resign last night, and he agreed. Emails show that Bennett Walsh had escalated his concerns to Llerena, and it just doesn't seem like Llerena either took them seriously or brought them to the right people. There was just a lot of poor communication and a lot of bad decision making on both his part and on Bennett Walsh's part. That's one of the big themes of the report, is that the management team and the leadership of the Department of Veteran Services just made a bunch of bad decisions.
You mentioned Bennett Walsh, the former superintendent of the Soldiers Home, was placed on leave. Do we know, are there any further repercussions that he's facing at this point?
We don't know the specifics yet. Governor Baker did seem to hint that he was going to be removed from office when he spoke at a press conference earlier today, but nothing that we can confirm so far. As mentioned, he has been on paid administrative leave since March 30th, and a couple weeks ago released a trove of email documents that he said absolved him of blame.
It's just such troubling observations and remarks from the staff. You have to imagine there are a lot of people that were involved in some of the decision making, at least. Is there any sign of anyone else being held accountable for this, and how will that procedure play out?
Sure. So when we talk about the management team at the Soldiers Home, we're really talking about 8 or 9 people, or maybe 9 or 10 if you include Bennett Walsh. And what was clear from this report is that they were a tight inner circle that didn't talk to other people, didn't let others in on their decision making process, didn't take advice from others, were at times vindictive. And retaliatory against staff who spoke out. And we do know that a number of them have been, I believe 4 have either resigned or have been demoted. The director of nursing has resigned. And then the director of medical director at the home, a guy named Dr. Clinton, also resigned a couple weeks ago. And the report had some pretty scathing things to say about him. It talks about how he, he was only part-time, and there's someone quoted saying they didn't really feel like he had the organizational skills to lead the soldier's home. He just wasn't up to the task. So he was out. And as the report notes, it's unclear that anyone, he developed symptoms that he thought were COVID-19 in mid to late March and took himself to the hospital. Turns out he was COVID negative, but he wasn't at the home during the worst of the outbreak. And as the report notes, it's unclear that anyone else filled in to be the medical director. So you can really imagine it's the people leading this.
Wow.
There was no medical director in charge. There was a director of nursing and then Bennett Walsh, who again has no medical experience, reporting to Francisco Llerena, who also has no medical experience. And one other thing note is that, and we at WBUR, we reported this story a couple weeks ago, that in 2016, the state legislature created a position within the Department of Veterans Services that was supposed to be directly accountable and was supposed to directly oversee both the Holyoke Soldiers Home and its sister facility in Chelsea. And that person needed to have healthcare management experience. And that job was just never filled. Francisco Llerena says it wasn't filled because of budgetary reasons, but really this report is just pointing out the fact that at every level, there was supposed to be someone accountable. That person just wasn't there, that job wasn't filled. And it was just a giant mess.
Yeah, pretty gut-wrenching to read through some of this, knowing it's obviously a life and death matter for so many. I want to ask you for a little bit of big picture perspective here before we let you go. You've been keeping up with coronavirus's impact in places like nursing homes or senior care facilities. I'm going to throw a couple of questions here at you. Have we seen higher death counts at senior long-term care facilities? And is the state working to address that? And are there lessons from Holyoke that we can extrapolate to other facilities?
Yeah, so long-term care facilities account for 63% of all coronavirus-related deaths in Massachusetts. So I think it's fair to say that they've been some of the hardest hit facilities anywhere. As far as how the state is working to address that, the state has set aside about $260 million in a couple different installments for nursing homes to work on infection control practices, to get the PPE they need, to bulk up on staffing, to test people who need to be tested. And that is an ongoing process. The state had mandated that all nursing homes test everyone, all staff and residents in May. And the vast majority of nursing homes actually did that. So then they were able to use the results of that data to either isolate people who needed to be isolated or figure out what to do. And the state also established what it called a 28-point infection control plan that is a bare minimum of what needs to be done. And the state has been auditing nursing homes and assisted living residences since May. For ones that are not passing the audits, they're sending resources and helping them meet these standards. So I would say that the coronavirus pandemic has definitely illuminated a lot of shortcomings at some of these facilities, and whether it's short staffing or kind of the nature of congregate care in general. A lot of these things have been brought to light by the pandemic. And though we haven't seen any sort of like long-term changes yet or big legislative changes, people that I talk to do think that some reform is coming eventually, and that's something that we should be on the lookout for. So the final question you asked was, are there any lessons from Holyoke to be applied at similar facilities? I would say, though this isn't, yeah, I mean, I think the idea is that you need people who have medical experience in jobs that require medical experience, and that transparency is really important, and that things can get out of control really, really quickly, and it's important to be prepared.
Hard to process that as we're thinking about 76 veterans that left their home, that lost their lives just at the Holyoke Soldiers Home. WBUR's Miriam Wasser, thanks so much for your time. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Chris.
In the video showing the killing of George Floyd, there were three officers standing by and watching as their colleague Derek Chauvin kneeled on Floyd's neck for 8 minutes and 46 seconds. In the weeks that have followed, one of the questions protesters and activists are asking is, why is it that when police violence happens, other officers are often just standing by and watching rather than stepping in to intervene? Here's how Suffolk County District Attorney Rachel Rollins put it on Radio Boston yesterday.
What is it about the police that we allow bad actors to continue behaving badly? And A, nobody says anything about it. And B, management doesn't terminate them. And C, DAs don't go in and say, I want to look at these internal affairs or anti-corruption investigations and see if we can root out these individuals that are behaving badly or even criminally.
For more, we're joined by Irvin Staub. He's professor emeritus of psychology and founding director with UMass Amherst, the Psychology of Peace and Violence Program. A Holocaust survivor, Staub has spent his life working to understand the roots of good and evil, and how acts of violence like genocide and mass killings are allowed to happen. And maybe most importantly, how to apply what he's learned to real-world interventions. One way he hopes to do that is through a police training program that focuses on empowering officers to step in and stop their colleagues from doing unnecessary harm. Irvin, thank you so much for being here today.
It's a pleasure.
Professor Staub, you've studied police violence and the role of bystanders, which includes other officers, since the Rodney King riots in 1992. And yet here we are almost 30 years later. We're still talking about the same issues. Why has this been such a hard problem to solve?
Well, there are many reasons for it. One of them is that the police culture is such that officers are expected by other officers and by their superior officers to support their fellow officer no matter what that officer does. So if that officer engages in some kind of unnecessary harmful behavior, other officers are expected either to support it actively or passively stand by, but not to go contrary to it. And that is a serious problem. And it's part of how police divides the world between us, the police, and the rest of the world. And that becomes a problem, of course.
Yeah. And so I know you've developed what is essentially active bystander training for police departments after the Rodney King incident. I know in New Orleans, they've adapted this training under a new name, EPIC, like Ethical Policing is Courageous. The New York Times describes it as teaching officers to police one another. Can you tell us a little bit about the training you've developed and the core principles behind it?
Well, the training is based on two kinds of research that I have done. One, research in laboratory environments, like at the university, where people hear sounds of distress from another room and a crash and sounds of distress. And depending on what that person says, the behavior of the other person varies a great deal. If somebody defines the situation as an emergency, as a need for help, and calls that other person for help, everybody helps. I also studied what happens in mass violence, mass killing and genocide, and that people, individuals or groups, when they engage in harmful behavior, they change as a result of their own actions, so that violence evolves, becomes more intense. And it's only prohibitive influences, like active bystanders who exert powerful influence, that stops this evolution. So I used these to create both an understanding on the part of police officers of what leads them to engage in unnecessary violence, of what is necessary in order to inhibit that, and also what are the benefits when they do that. So one benefit, of course, is civilians are not going to be injured and harmed unnecessarily. Another benefit is police-community relations. Another thing is that active bystandership saves police officers from losing their jobs. It also is very important for ethical officers in a department where there is a lot of unethical behavior that they will be less stressed. Once you engage them in this training, they see the benefits of it. And at least in New Orleans, they welcomed it and everybody pretty enthusiastically participated.
So I guess my question to that is, you've had training like this in development since the early 90s, and yet we haven't seen a large number of police departments take advantage of something like this. Why do you think that is?
You know, it hasn't received wide attention. The New Orleans training, because it seemed so successful, received a lot of attention in the media. And the circumstances now are such that the need for it is so crucial. We saw what happened to George Floyd and the other officers remaining passive. And a few days later, there was an event in Seattle where a police officer was doing something very similar to what the officer was doing to George Floyd, kneeling on the neck of a person lying on the ground. And another officer said to him, "Get off." And the officer did not get off, and this other officer shoved him off the neck of the person, saved that person's life, and probably saved also his fellow officer. Here is an example of passive bystandership and active bystandership. And it is so powerful when you see it in action. And, you know, we can train people not to use a particular practice and make it illegal, like chokeholds. But there are so many ways to harm people that it's not enough to make a particular practice illegal or unacceptable. You have to make all such behavior unacceptable and have to get other officers who are present to stop it. And that could really, truly transform policing in America.
I mentioned we talked to Suffolk County District Attorney Rachel Rollins yesterday, and she characterized Derek Chauvin, who kneeled on George Floyd's neck, as a bad actor. You've dedicated your life to studying good and evil in so many different contexts, including the police, obviously, but also, as you mentioned, in terms of genocide and mass killings. I'm wondering, is the ultimate goal, can you train out bad apples, or will there always be bad apples and the ultimate goal is to empower those around the bad actors to step in?
There is only one way to train out bad apples, and that is to create a department, and this training can do that, that make such behavior unacceptable. If a so-called bad apple knows that other officers will intervene and not accept such behavior, when the whole climate in that police unit changes, then it becomes much less likely that bad apples do their bad things. So it's not like necessarily the nature of that officer will change, but it is the understanding of that officer of their environment and what is acceptable and unacceptable that can change. You could say that in a department and most departments where other officers remain passive, everybody is a bad apple. Seeing an officer do really harmful behavior to someone when it is not necessary and remaining passive, that means that you are a bad apple. So this training, I believe, because some of these people are good people, but the culture and their training and their experience and all of that makes them remain passive, that turns them into bad apple. So we can transform that. We can change that. and the climate that develops can be transformative.
Yeah, that is a big lift that you're asking in terms of changing the culture across police departments across the country. And I'm curious how you're thinking about that as we're hearing this national push to defund or basically decrease funding for police departments. We've seen in Minneapolis, for example, the department was disbanded to be rebuilt. So some folks are calling for huge structural change. You're talking about a training program. I'm wondering how you see that fitting in. Either is that intervention in the system that exists, or do you see that, how do you see that fitting into the picture as we're thinking about structurally how law enforcement looks in this country?
Yeah. Well, you know, what happened in New Orleans, the department was really bad in terms of harmful actions. There was a new superintendent. So that's a very big step to find the right person to lead a department and the superior officers and general. So that is already transformational. But there was no disbanding, there was no huge changes, and then this training came in. So if there is the right leadership, and if there is the right training, and if officers who find such a training unacceptable and cannot go along with it, then along the way, if necessary, they are weeded out. But it may not be necessary if the huge majority support it. Now, one problem with police units, is contracts with police unions that protect officers that behave badly no matter what. I mean, a lot of these contracts don't even allow any reports of unnecessary violent behavior, unnecessary harmful behavior. So that has to change. And that's important. Now, is it necessary to dismantle police departments for that to happen? Is it necessary only for people in charge to be willing to confront police unions and change agreements and contracts so that the contracts do not allow such protection for police officers who behave badly? I think that that going together with such a training could really do what is necessary. I think that if the people in charge of a city are committed enough, if the legislature is committed enough to have community boards that actually have some power to supervise police, that would be extremely valuable. But this training could go a long way to solve the problems.
Professor Staub, we asked you here today to talk about a very specific aspect of your research. You obviously have a very powerful story to tell. Love to have you back sometime down the road to talk more about that, if that's something you'd be interested in.
It would be a pleasure to be back, and thank you for having invited me. I enjoy talking to you.
That's Irvin Staub, a professor emeritus of psychology and founding director with UMass Amherst, the Psychology of Peace and Violence program. Staub has worked to create active bystander police training to empower officers to stop their colleagues from doing unnecessary harm. Summer is here. If the 90 degree days didn't tip it off, it also means school is out and parents are looking for fun things to do to keep those kiddos entertained. And if you're like me, I'm guessing you're asking some of these same questions. How do you make summer vacation fun in the middle of a pandemic? Everything from trips to playgrounds, team sports, play dates, it's all kind of underlined by this theme of what's safe and what's not. And I'm sure you've got your own questions about how to handle summer vacation with your kids. We're going to bring you two great guests to help answer those. So go ahead and jump on board 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining us now is Dr. Rick Malley. He's a senior physician in pediatrics in the Division of Infectious Diseases at Boston Children's Hospital and also a professor of pediatrics at Harvard Medical School. Dr. Malley, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you for having me.
And also with us is Peter Gray. He's a research professor of psychology at Boston College, author of Free to Learn, and co-founder of Let Grow, a nonprofit that promotes child-led play. Peter, welcome back to you as well.
Very happy to be here.
So Dr. Malley, I want to start with you and ask you kind of where kids fit into this pandemic. If we go back to when we first started learning about coronavirus, there was some concern that they'd be so-called super spreaders. Have we learned any more about the role kids play in spreading coronavirus?
I think we have, although there's still a lot to learn. At the outset of the pandemic, exactly as you said, most people really thought that this was going to follow the same pattern as other common respiratory viruses like the flu, where children are really, unfortunately, the main vectors of transmission. And so a lot of people were worried that that was going to be the case. But we had read reports from China that really indicated that children were somewhat more likely to resist the negative consequences of this infection and not get quite as sick. So that was the first puzzle. The second puzzle was that we found out from other countries like Iceland and Israel and other countries across the world that not only were children less likely to get sick, they were also less likely to even catch the virus in their nose and therefore less likely to spread it. Now, it isn't to say that they can't get sick from the virus. We certainly have, unfortunately, many examples of that. But they do seem to be more resistant to getting sick, and they also seem to be probably more resistant to serving as ping pong players to spread the virus across their families or other members of the community.
It's really interesting. I've got a son who will be 5 this summer, and so I can tell you firsthand, wearing masks, washing your hands, it all looks great on paper. That can be a real challenge, actually, on the ground. Do you have kind of any general advice for parents in terms of how to keep your kids safe as we're starting to enter the summer months?
Yeah, it's a very interesting and important question you're asking. I think we all recognize that our dream of running around in the park or on the beach with our kids did not involve them wearing masks and staying 6 feet away from other children or other people even that you know and are friendly with. But I do think that we have to take a certain amount of precautions, because even though children are less likely to get sick and less likely to transmit, probably, they still can get sick and they can still probably spread the virus. And therefore, the recommendations we make is to, if the child is old enough, like your children, old enough to understand what we're trying to do, to explain to them that you can have fun, you can be outside. In fact, we want you to be outside, but we want you to follow a few rules that did not exist until 6 months ago. And those are the rules of staying a little bit away from people who are not directly in your family unit or in your social bubble. And also, when and if the child is willing, to wear a mask so that they do not infect others. And I think that's a very empowering statement you can make to a child, to say that the reason they're wearing masks is to make sure that they're keeping all the other people safe as well.
It's a great way to look at it. Peter, I want to bring you in here, and we are going to open this up to some listener calls and questions as well. 1-800-423-8255 if you want to join the conversation. Peter, I mentioned in your intro, you've spent your career researching play. Can you talk a little bit about the importance of play in a child's development, and what have you seen in the last few months during the pandemic?
Yeah, well, you know, play is crucial to children's development. And much of my research shows that over the last few decades, our children have been very play deprived. They spend so much time in school, so much time at homework after school, so much time in adult-directed activities, which are not fully play. Play is activity that children develop themselves, that children take control of themselves, where children learn to be independent and solve their own problems. So I've done a lot of research that shows that as we deprive children more and more of free play, we get more anxious, more depressed, less resilient children. We have huge increases in childhood suicide over the last several decades, and which of course is just the tip of the iceberg. What my research suggests is because children are so often in stressful, competitive kinds of activities, such as school, and have so little time to just really be children, to play. So what's interesting right now is all these things that have kept children so busy have been shut off. And what are the consequences of that? Well, the Let Grow nonprofit, which I'm a part of, has recently completed a major survey of families across the country. We've surveyed 800 families, pretty well balanced for socioeconomic group, geographic placement, and so on. These are all families that have children between the age of 8 and 13. And we asked a lot of questions about how the parents are coping. There were questions directed to the parents and questions directed to the target child within the family. Let me just give you a little bit of the data. I mean, the data were surprising even to me, and I think they will be even more surprising to others. So one of the questions was to the children was, are you more calm now or less calm than you were when you were before the school closures? 49% said more calm. 25% said less calm, and the rest said about the same. We asked the parents the same question. 43% said they are now less stressed. 29% said more stressed. The others said no difference. Now, here's something that, you know, you introduced this by saying, how do we keep kids entertained? The interesting thing that parents are learning is they don't have to entertain their kids. Kids are pretty darn good at finding ways to entertain themselves. It took a while in some cases. They were bored, you know, but boredom is a good thing. They figured out what to do. So we got responses from the kids saying things like, you know, I've owned a guitar for 2 years and I've never had time to learn to play it. I have learned to play the guitar. I've been watching YouTubes and playing the guitar. We've heard from many kids who are riding bicycles for the first time. Imagine that. We're growing a generation of kids who aren't learning to ride bicycles because they're kept so busy, and also because we're so afraid they'll get hurt out there on the bicycle. Well, the traffic slowed down for a while. Kids didn't have much else to do. This is a safe way to get out and play. So, you know, I've heard from parents who say, I can't buy a bicycle. There's a run on bicycles. You know, so there's an interesting phenomenon here. I don't want to say this is all
good. It is interesting. Obviously there's a lot.
Obviously there are families suffering. Obviously, we probably didn't hear from the families that, you know, that just hate one another within the family. You don't want to be stuck at home there. We probably heard from the families who are coping a little better than some of the other families. But what's really interesting is these parents are saying, I am impressed by my children. They are more responsible. They're taking more control of themselves. Many of them are doing homework. They're asked housework.
It is interesting.
Housework that I didn't think they were capable of doing.
It is interesting that I'm struck by a lot of what you're talking about. Obviously sounds great, but there is a privilege component here too, right? Not everybody can go out and buy a bike or has space in a backyard for kids to play, or you know, maybe parents who are frontline workers who are still having to go into the office and they're trying to figure out childcare situations. How are you thinking about that as you're processing the data?
Well, I think that's a very, very good point. And it's hard to know. But what I can tell you is that the problem that existed before this pandemic is across social class. It's across race. Children have been suffering because of deprivation of play. And the primary reason for the deprivation of play is not having time to do it. And because we're living in a world where people feel that it's unsafe for children to go outdoors, we've exaggerated the dangers. And this is across social class. There was a time a couple of decades ago when this was more common in the so-called more privileged classes. They were more overprotective of their children than people who are economically less privileged. Now this is across social class, partly because people are afraid they'll be arrested if they send their children out to play.
That's a can of worms that we could get into another time. I do want to make sure we get some calls in here, so let's go to the phones. Cebu in Sudbury is on the line. Welcome to Radio Boston, Cebu.
Thanks for having me. My question in this context kind of maybe, and I'm hearing all the benefits, and I think I agree with some of those things that are intrinsically happening with trying to expand ways that children are staying busy. My comment would be, you know, I'm a very personable person, and I like to think my son is 4 and a half, is also developing to be the same way. How do you start to explain some more of the uncertainty around just running into folks, say, in public areas where, you know, you are trying to get outside? That's kind of my first question. And my second question is in terms of how do you keep your, so more the flip side of that, your private circle, how do you sort of ensure that folks are taking it seriously, you know, the virus seriously, and being able to interact with them, both indoors and outdoors, right? Because summer will come to an end. Thank you.
Yeah, it's a great question. Dr. Malley, let me bring you in on this, because I think socialization obviously has a number of benefits, but how do you balance that with the health concerns?
Yeah, it's a challenge we've all been facing. I think it's helpful to remember that even though we can't put a number to the risk that is associated with, for example, crossing somebody in the hallway or on the elevator or even in a park, just running into somebody and sort of even bumping into them and then moving away, it just doesn't seem likely that that represents a huge risk of transmission. And therefore, when one tries to explain to children, depending on their age, of course, what should or should not be done, I think it can be done in a way where you're trying to explain to the child that it's important to reduce those interactions, to limit that type of, close contact, if you will, with somebody that is not part of their family or their social bubble, but without giving them this fear, this anxiety that all of a sudden they've entered some sort of radioactive zone when they're in the face of someone that they don't know. I think that really can help quite a bit to reduce the anxiety and the frustration that people might have. I do think it's absolutely critically important that we take advantage of good weather, that we bring kids outside, that we re-engage in the type of activities that make our kids healthier and happier. Without creating the sense that just because you're temporarily and very briefly closer to someone than maybe you and I would like for our child, that is going to represent a significant risk.
Yeah. I want to go back to the phones at 1-800-423-8255. Danny in Cambridge, you're up next. Welcome to the show, Danny. What's on your mind?
Hey, thank you so much for taking my call. A question for your guest. I have a 27-month-old. And forget about the fact that I can't get this kid to put on a mask to save my life. He hates when I wear my mask. It really bothers him. And my question
is... Oh, Danny, you're speaking my language. I got an 18-month-old that's doing the same thing. Right? Cries as soon as it goes on.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's awful. And, you know, daycares are opening back up. Our daycare center is opening back up at the end of July. And I think the thing that concerns me is that I know that developmentally, small children are really reliant on facial expressions. And what scares me is, you know, what is this going to affect our children developmentally when they go back to daycare and, you know, their teachers all have face masks on? You know, how are they going to be able to read their expressions, to connect with them, to form those deep bonds and those connections that will affect them for the rest of their life? Is this something that, I mean, is this something that we really need to be concerned about? And if so, how do we mitigate that? How do we rectify that at home?
Yeah, great question, Danny. I'll throw that up to either of you, Rick Malley, Peter Gray, whoever wants to jump on that.
I have one thought to that, which may surprise some people. You know, you can see facial expressions on Zoom or on the computer. So one possibility is even with little kids, let them interact with their friends and other people over the computer. At least it's not perfect. It doesn't take the place of physical hugs and jostling and all of that, but at least it's if you're concerned about losing the opportunity to respond to physical expressions. You know, of course, during this time we've all been on Zoom a heck of a lot more than we ever were before, and I think what everybody's finding is it those computer when you're looking at one another, it's certainly better than being on the telephone. You're interacting.
Let's go back to the phones here. Ravit in Cambridge, you're up next. Ravit, what's on your mind?
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I wanted to ask Dr. Malley. He mentioned you mentioned a social bubble, and I was wondering how many families do you recommend to connect together to form that bubble?
It's a great question. Dr. Malley, what do you say?
Yeah, I think like anything, it's a matter of knowing your friends and the members of your bubble. In other words, if you said to me, I have two families that I'm very close to and they have kids and we have all pledged to really only see one another and nobody else. And that could amount, if they each have a couple kids, you have a couple kids, that can amount to like a pretty big group of people. But as long as everybody is respectful of that contract to the extent possible, then I think that's not an unsafe situation. What you don't want is a situation where, for example, your friends are part of six different social bubbles, sort of jumping around from one group to another and another, because then, unfortunately, the whole contract is basically void as far as I'm concerned. And so more than the number of families that you're willing to include, I would consider using your own judgment of how much risk you're willing to take for yourself and for your families. For example, you know, restaurants are now open indoors, open outdoors. Personally, I think that it's very rational to try to decide for yourself whether you feel more comfortable with people who are going to be, for example, eating outdoors at the restaurant rather than going inside. And that might be a way to judge whether people in your bubble are respecting that same degree of risk that you're taking on for your own family. And that might help you decide. Go ahead.
Oh, I was gonna tag another on. We don't have time for any more calls, but Karen in Carlisle was gonna ask about her 15-year-old and whether they should be babysitting small kids. I'd imagine your advice is something similar lines. Understand the families you'd be working with and how they're approaching the situation.
Absolutely, yes. I think you're absolutely right. It's good to get that information. These days, fortunately, it will not be viewed as being intrusive to ask people how they are managing the pandemic. Actually, it's a very interesting conversation. And I think, you know, people learn from one another that way, what works, what doesn't, what makes them feel comfortable. And I think if somebody wants to have a job such as babysitting, it would be very important to understand what the other family is doing.
Yeah, that's Dr. Rick Malley, senior physician in pediatrics in the Division of Infectious Diseases at Boston Children's Hospital and a professor of pediatrics at Harvard Medical School. Dr. Malley, thanks so much for the time.
My pleasure.
And also with us is Peter Gray, research professor of psychology at Boston College, author of Free to Learn and co-founder of Let Grow, a nonprofit that promotes child-led play. Peter, thanks so much for your time, too.
Thank you for having me on.